Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today's program is all about games, which humans have played across cultures and for millennia, and which make up some of our earliest individual experiences with socialization and rules. While tossing the idea around, I had to fess up to my colleagues that I have not played a video game since, well, since Pong. I know that globally, millions of people of all stripes are gamers. I'm in the media. I talk to gamers frequently. I know what's out there for electronic games and about gameplay culture and creativity and sexism and concerns about violence, but had never put one of those consoles into my own hands. So it was time to try. We chose the game Skyfall. Actually, it's called Skyrim, but my brain defaulted to the name of a Bond film that I know. Cold comfort for my utterly new experience in a brilliantly crafted medieval universe where I was a character armed with a mace and some kind of magic hand.
So here I have my sort of crozier. I guess it's not a crozier when it's used
this
for killing.
This is a mace.
Mace.
And your left
I've
hand
got
is
my
a...
mace in the right hand, and my left hand is shooting lightning.
Yeah.
With producers Taylor Quimby and Zach Nugent as my gamer guides, I dove in console first.
Your two index fingers, you want to be on these back triggers here that are almost like joystick triggers.
Oh,
now, if you pull your right trigger.
Oh, I just swiped at someone pretty mightily.
And I have to admit, it was fun. It made me want to practice and learn how to play better. But I did learn a few key lessons. One, look ahead, not up.
I just want to see what's here. But I think I'm looking up in the air again.
Two, know the purpose of the game before starting.
So you're basically, we're just cruising around waiting for something bad to happen, right?
Three, be prepared to defeat your enemies at a moment's notice.
Oh, there's somebody behind you.
Oh, what happens now?
You gotta flip around and kill him.
Turn around and kill him.
No.
I gotta get closer to him. Hey, why is this thing buzzing?
Oh.
I'm getting slaughtered!
And if failing miserably, change your strategy.
You could get a sword that's got a little further reach.
Yeah.
And you could change your magic so it might help kill these guys with less aim, that sort of thing.
Okay, that would be really good for me.
Number four, pause every now and then and take in the beauty.
It is actually quite a pretty universe here.
And number five, be patient.
Oh, see, look, you're already moving much faster than you were a few minutes ago.
Noticeably better.
Okay, there's a bad guy. Stop. Okay. He hasn't seen you yet. Sort of aim towards him.
See that, like, middle little aimer?
There we go. Yeah, the little aimer thing. Now press the, hold on, press the left button, the fire one. Hold it down. Let it go. You got him on fire. He's on fire.
Do it. Oh, really?
Yeah, he's on fire. Wow.
Oh, crap.
Okay. Run away.
I can't.
But being patient is tough. It was extremely frustrating not to have the eye-hand coordination to move around quickly or defend myself from all manner of attackers.
I have to go back up
the tower. You probably have to go back up the
tower. Oh, what?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Okay,
done. See, that's the first. That's where you throw the thing. That's where you throw your controller.
It was enough to have me longing for a tense, competitive game of Trivial Pursuit after a family dinner. There is something to that frustration, it turns out. Yeah, we've all heard the debate about whether graphically violent video games lead to aggressive or hostile behavior among players. A new study suggests it may not be the content that drives the player's anger, but frustration. That would mean that controversial games like Grand Theft Auto may have less impact on player behavior than the 1980 arcade classic Defender, which is commonly ranked among the most difficult video games of all time. So let the games begin. First up, Andrew Shabilsky, researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute and co-author of the study linking frustration to aggressive behavior. I asked him about the sorts of gameplay that the study linked to aggression and what it is that makes a game frustrating to play.
Actually, what we found was it's the opposite side of the coin of the kinds of things that make games so popular and so motivating and so fun. And so what we actually investigated was the ways in which, instead of supporting basic psychological needs, the kinds of ways that maybe games thwart them by having either very complex control schemes overly complicated challenges and too steep of a learning curve, not enough opportunities for kind of growth and development of the player across the course of play.
So how did you conduct the study?
Well, actually, you could say it is a study, but in fact, it was seven studies or eight studies, depending on how you count. And so what we did was we used a number of different methods to manipulate a sense of player competence. So in a set of the studies, what we did was we manipulated the amount of time participants were allowed to practice learning how to play the basics of a video game before they were exposed to any violent or nonviolent content. In another set of studies, what we did was we actually manipulated how complicated the control interface was. So we had a fairly simple puzzle game, but we either had participants, we randomly assigned them to play with very simple game controls that were very intuitive, or very complicated ones that made them think constantly. And then finally, the other thing we did was we actually manipulated the in-game challenges of a video game. So instead of giving pieces fairly in a puzzle game, the puzzle game Tetris, what we reprogrammed the logic of the game to give an impossible combination of pieces. So no matter how good players were, the challenges were always overwhelming them.
One of the challenges, it appears, that you added was having the players hold their hands in very, very extremely cold water for 10 seconds. So their fingers would, what, be less malleable, less flexible?
Oh, no. We used the, a dirty little secret a lot of psychology research is that it's very, very difficult to study human aggression. You can call something an aggressive behavior in the lab, but it doesn't necessarily in any way correlate with kind of the things that wind up getting people suspended or put in prison. And so actually the cold water task that you're alluding to here was our method of actually measuring how aggressive players were. And so what we had was we had everyone stick their hands in the cold water for 25 seconds. And then at the end of the study, after the end of the experiment, we asked the participants how long should the next participant put their hand in the freezing cold water. And so we actually used that as a measurement of how kind of angry and how aggressive the participant was feeling. So they believed they were putting their hand in the cold water for the reason that you thought. We told them it was about video game performance and physiological reactivity. But in fact, what we were really interested in was how much more or less pain was the participant going to assign to someone else.
Wow, you would have had me on that one. Well, you used both violent and nonviolent games in your study. Was there any correlation between the content and the behavior?
Well, yeah. So one of the things that our studies did was when we introduced violent game content, in some of the studies, instead of just, you know, using two different video games that we pulled off the shelf, what we actually did was we manipulated a single video game. We added or took away violent content in terms of imagery, and we added and took away violent content in terms of the narrative, in terms of the story. So that way we were sure that the motivational aspects of the game were held constant. So what we did find was that when we made the video game more violent, when we made the story kind of more like a killer be killed narrative, players felt more on edge. They felt more threatened. But we didn't find that they actually felt more aggressive. Their feelings of aggression were very potently tied to kind of how competent they felt when they played, and was also tied to the opportunity to practice ahead of time. We found across the studies that when participants felt like their psychological need for competence was frustrated or impeded, they tended to increase in aggression, aggressive feelings during the course of play. They also had a much less fun time playing the video game.
And more likely to assign somebody else to pain.
Yeah. So on average, participants who played the competence thwarting version of the video game, they assigned 10 more seconds of physical pain than those who played the normal version.
We're speaking with Andrew Shabilsky, a researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute. That's at Oxford University. And he's co-author of a study about violent video games and aggression. Results may not be exactly what you think. Andrew, actually play this out, and if you could, with a game that a lot of people might know. You know, so I am playing blank game. What are the kind of components to this game that might challenge my competency, as you said, or frustrate me? And what are those rewards?
Yeah, sure. So every video game designer attempts to design a game that kind of balances the rewards of a game against the challenges that are presented. So, for instance, there's a very popular online video game called Halo 4.
Mm-hmm.
Halo 4 is a competitive online first-person shooter where teams of superhumans kind of duke it out online, and they play essentially capture the flag and these other tasks. The creators of this game, Microsoft, they try very hard to make sure that every time that you log on to play, you're matched against people who are about as good as you, people who are just as good at, you know, dodging attacks and just as good at firing weapons and achieving the objectives of the game, because they know that if you get put up continuously against either of those people that are very easy to defeat and you just get a bunch of rewards for easy slam dunk victories, or if they put you up against people who are amazingly better than you, it's not going to make for a fun play experience. On one end, it's going to drive a lot of boredom and disengagement. And on the other end, it's going to drive a lot of frustration and disengagement.
Does the frustration aggression thing apply to behavior outside of the video game world? I think, of course, of sports.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think sports is an obvious area where the game may not specifically be about aggression, so you don't need it to be football. You can have it be baseball. And having a frustration of your needs can definitely make you angry. You could also think of something like road rage, just your commute home. You've got the goal of having had a long day at work and you just want to get home to your family, and someone cuts you off going around the roundabout. And you feel threatened and you feel unsafe and you feel like you've got to go around the roundabout again. And that can definitely drive some short-term feelings of aggression.
Andrew, the question of whether or not violent video games, graphic video games, lead to aggressive behavior among players is not going away at any time soon. What do you think the results of your study might add to that conversation or discussion about the effect of games on players?
I'm hoping really that our research on motivational sources of aggression kind of has two effects on the way that this perennial debate is going to happen moving forward. The first way is a message to other researchers in the field. This research says that it is not sufficient for someone who's interested in studying the effects of video games just to compare any two random video games you buy off the shelf. A lot of things get manipulated when you just manipulate video games by picking different games. They're motivationally very different. And so really moving forward, my hope is that other researchers are going to take motivational issues seriously, and they're going to use the kind of programming tools that we use to manipulate individual video games to make sure that only the content of video games is different when they're making their comparisons. Second, the other main thing that comes out of this research for our group is in terms of society. Our hope in this is that people understand not just whether or not there's a statistically significant link between something like violent video games and some real world correlative aggression, but to have people think very critically about kind of the size of that correlation. And so the correlation is actually quite small. It's somewhere on the order of between half of 1% and 2%. So there are many things like the number of siblings in your household that are much, much better predictors of whether or not you get in trouble at school or you have some kind of conduct problem.
Well, Andrew Shabilsky, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime.
Andrew Shabilsky is a researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute, that is at Oxford University. We do have more on the study at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we turn from high-tech video games and go old school. How crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter are leading a board game renaissance. We'll pass go when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After decades of rehashed Monopoly boards and revised editions of Candyland, the board game renaissance is in full swing, led in part by the ability of tabletop gamers to discover and support new games through crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter. Among them, Clayton Gray and Sam Strick, the designers behind Laboratory Games. So far, they have successfully funded two games on Kickstarter, most recently Province. It's a two-player miniature board game about the size of a wallet. Producer Taylor Quimby reached out to them to talk about the appeal of crowdsourcing and why, when it comes to board games at least, size doesn't matter.
So first of all, this game is described as a Euro game. So if you could tell me what that is, and keep in mind, a lot of our listeners probably haven't played a board game since the last time they picked up Monopoly at Thanksgiving.
So Eurogame is referring to a particular style of game that came out of Europe that became very popular globally, maybe about a little more than a decade ago, starting with a game called Settlers of Catan and another game called Carcassonne. And Eurogames in particular are unique because they revolve around usually economy management as opposed to sort of spatial orientation like a game chess or Monopoly, where what you're focusing on is where people are on a board. So when we went ahead and designed a province, we wanted to try to design something that had the sort of gameplay that you expect from a Euro game.
But smaller.
Again, yeah, but much smaller. Euro games typically take about 3 hours to play, and frankly, we don't always have that time.
So Clayton, I understand the original design of the game, it was going to be maybe as small as a business card. It ended up being a little bit bigger, but how does that size play into, you know, its role as a game? Like, do you play it differently because it's so small?
No, I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, we're making a big game in a small form. Like, when you play it, like, the size is sort of belies its complexity. We're making it in a small form so that it's easily distributable. It's something that people can take around with them, and it doesn't have the sort of intimidating form factor of some of the, like, heavier component-laden games that you find that are popular out on the market.
Right.
Yeah, actually, to that point, if you look at a game like Monopoly, most of that board is actually space you don't end up using when you're playing Monopoly. A lot of it's just like the center of the board. So what we're doing as game designers is we're eliminating as much of that empty space as possible to make sure that the only parts that are on the board are parts that you use. So picture Monopoly without that center and how small it could probably be while retaining all of its Monopoly assets.
Why do you think Kickstarter has become such a central place for tabletop games? I mean, you know, compared to other types of projects on Kickstarter, games seem to have a very good track record for successfully completing their funding and coming to market.
It's tricky. I mean, the reason that a Kickstarter is a blessing and a curse. If you find success there and you find it early, chances are you're going to do very well. But there are also a lot of projects that don't make it. So like when you look at Kickstarter right now, there are thousands of projects on Kickstarter where people only tend to see the stuff at the top. So if you don't get to be up there, then that's a real challenge. But at the same time, as from a creator's perspective, with that challenge acknowledged, it's a real advantage to be able to sort of say, okay, we've got this design, we can show it directly to the people who might be interested in it, and they can fund it directly. In the traditional sort of way of making things, we would need to put money into it beforehand and fully manufacture the game and then put it out on the market and say, do you like this? Without having any sense of, like, is this actually a good idea or is this just something we happen to be into that no one else has any interest in? And I think that's the real draw, both from big companies and small producers like us, to be able to say, like, can we vet this idea at least from a sort of, like, showing it to people's standpoint and say, like, would you buy this? Is this something that you're excited about?
Well, from a consumer point of view, I mean, I look at Kickstarter and I see a lot of projects that, you know, maybe sound interesting, but you really don't know how they're going to turn out, especially, say, artistic projects where, you know, you're looking at somebody's, you know, history and wondering whether their new album or their new film is going to turn out to be interesting or worth paying for. But, you know, with a board game, you can pretty much lay out the design, the gameplay. You can basically show me the product that you've already got and then ask, you know, your consumers whether or not they want to pay for it.
And that's kind of a scary side of it, too, for me as a designer, and I think for Clayton as well, because Kickstarter was originally pitched to the world as, you have an idea, let's get it funded. And what Kickstarter's kind of turned into is, do you have a finished product that hasn't been produced? Let's get it funded. So the lead-up time before you can kickstart something has expanded exponentially. So now when we want to kickstart something, we need to basically have the game more or less complete so that people who want to fund it see exactly what they're getting. It's turned into more of a store instead of a marketplace for ideas. So as designers, that's kind of put more work on our table. But frankly, having Kickstarter at all has been a blessing.
Yeah. Do you think in the future, you know, the idea is that you get successful enough that you don't need it? Or would you still probably go back there as a way of keeping in touch with people and, I don't know, feeling out the crowd?
There's a question to that, and I don't think anybody knows the answer yet. Like it or not, it is now a part of everybody's business models. Like, it's not a matter of, like, oh, is everybody going to use this or not? At some point, it just makes so much sense to try to do. It's hard to do, and it's only going to get more difficult. But at the same time, there's a place for it. And it provides so much power, both to creators and consumers, to sort of have direct access to one another in that way.
Clayton, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Sam Strick, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Together, Clayton Gray and Sam Strick are Laboratory Games. Here's a quick update on their miniature board game, Province. It is now fully funded. Their goal was $5,000, and they raised $48,000. You can find a link to their game on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Today, Word of Mouth is all about games, and the play continues with a fresh perspective on an old classic, Monopoly. Turns out its creator was anti-monopolist.
So Lizzie McGee wanted to give to the world a board game that would show that, all right, we cannot allow the few to monopolize land, or else the rest of us will all be in the poorhouse.
Stay with us for that when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The official website for the classic board game Monopoly boasts that it sold more than 275 million games worldwide. It's been released in 43 languages, in Braille, in chocolate, and was used for secret communications by the British Secret Service during World War II. According to Hasbro history, Monopoly was invented in 1933 by Charles Darrow, an unemployed radiator repairman from Philly. But that American success story masks Monopoly's more interesting origins. Christopher Ketchum is a columnist at Counterpunch and a freelance writer whose work has appeared in GQ, Vanity Fair, and Harper's Magazine. That's where he wrote about the history of the world's most popular, though hardly populist, board game. Christopher, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey there.
Decades before Parker Brothers patented Monopoly back in 1935, it was called something like the Landlord's Game. Now, tell us, who created it and where the idea came from?
The Landlord's Game was the invention of an actress and sometime cross-dresser named Lizzie McGee, who stage acted in Baltimore and Washington. She wanted to create a game that taught that being a landlord was evil because landlords controlled land, and in doing so, they could basically send renters into poverty by constantly raising rents. Now, McGee was actually a follower of a 19th century economist and philosopher named Henry George, who taught that land ownership in America especially had resulted in monopoly power over an inelastic commodity. That is land, inelastic because as demand increases, you cannot increase supply. Uh-huh. So Lizzie McGee wanted to give to the world a board game that would teach Henry George's philosophy and would show that, all right, we cannot allow the few to monopolize land, or else the rest of us will all be in the poorhouse.
It's just so ironic that this becomes a game about, you know, celebrating the monopolist, celebrating the one who squeezes the most money out of everybody else.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. But a perfect example of how, you know, modern capitalism works. I mean, the game is invented by Lizzie McGee. It's embellished, and the rules are advanced by all sorts of different players throughout the years, a professor at the Wharton School of Finance, college players all throughout the East Coast, the major Ivies, the Quakers, or groups of Quakers in the Northeast, and especially in Atlantic City, take to it, and they, again, start advancing its rules. And so you have this sort of communal process, this communal labor that goes into the creation of what becomes Monopoly. So the game has moved virally throughout cities and colleges, and it ends up in Atlantic City in the beginning of the Depression. And there it is played by two brothers, the Rayfords, and the Rayford brothers share it with the putative inventor, Charles Darrow. And Charles Darrow then goes on to commit fraud. He copies down the rules, he copies down the board and the chance cards, the community chess cards, et cetera, et cetera. And then he goes on to claim that he was the sole inventor. He goes to Parker Brothers, and Parker Brothers, whose executives know about the Monopoly prehistory. They know that Charles Darrow is not the inventor. They know about this long history of communal labor. But they join him in the fraud and approach the U.S. Patent Office to get a fraudulent patent. As a result of that fraudulent patent, Monopoly, which theretofore had been a public domain game played by anyone, freely exchanged, like chess or checkers or dominoes, now becomes a privatized commodity for sale in the marketplace, monopolized by a single corporation.
Why do you think the new version took off so well? I mean, it was not just played by radicals and socialists.
Probably because it plays to our worst basest acquisitive instincts. I mean, a lot of the people I spoke to who, the Monopoly historians who had played the original Landlord's Game, found it rather boring because, you know, everyone was cooperating and you know, everyone's making nice, and the idea was creating a utopian society. But I guess utopian societies aren't much fun, at least in board game form.
But nobody ends up feeling good walking away. You've either stomped on somebody or you're in the poorhouse. It doesn't really make people feel good.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, in my family, we would compete. I loved competing. I was cheating all the time.
I always cheated, too. That's why I don't like about the electronic version. You can't cheat.
That was the whole heart of Monopoly for me as a kid. It was cheating. Everything was about cheating, which, of course, is perfectly reflects what capitalism is today in America. Competing, no, not really competing, but competing in such a way that you're stabbing competitors in the back.
Okay, so Christopher, what does this mean? That you are a sort of secret cutthroat capitalist somewhere underneath there? That's part of your human nature?
No, I think what happened is, as my part of my training as a child in playing this game was toward being a cutthroat capitalist, but I have since struggled against the malediction.
Well, as part of the research for the story, you spent a day at the annual corporate Monopoly tournament in Pittsburgh and got to witness a variety of different strategies. Did you get any sense that the players there were using some sort of strategy that the rest of us aren't aware of? Is there a key to winning at Monopoly?
The only key to winning at Monopoly is to get monopolies. That's it. That's it. You know, the roll of the dice is basically the determining factor there is luck. And then I guess a certain amount of risk-taking in terms of your purchases, in terms of your ratio of available capital to the property that you're buying. But on the other hand, when you watch these tournaments, everybody buys every piece of property they always land on. And then they start trading. So I suppose it is constant acquisition coupled with the willingness to barter and trade. You know, you make judgments. You say, okay, if I trade this guy Park Place and he trades me Ventnor and Marvin Gardens, then we'll both have monopolies. How powerful is my monopoly compared to his monopoly, et cetera, et cetera. Among these players, I did find that they had read statistical accountings of exactly which properties are the most landed on. For example, the properties downboard from the jail are the most landed on statistically because you end up at the jail far more often than any other specific square because of the community chess cards, the chance cards, and the go-to-jail space.
I'm thinking that, you know, probably in Lizzie McGee's sort of version, you know, this is all about chance, obviously, but not about that early economic thinking of capitalism as unleashing creativity and innovation and creating competition and opening markets and expanding trade. What do you think Lizzie McGee would think of today's version of Monopoly, the one that has become so popular?
It's an abomination. I mean, she would just think this is a joke, and the joke's on her. Obviously, the whole message of Monopoly has been inverted. The whole history of the game has been erased. And the process by which the game was formed, again, that communal labor that I referenced earlier, that too has been erased and replaced rather by this myth of the sole inventor, Charles Darrow, who, of course, became a multimillionaire as a result of Monopoly.
Well, Christopher Ketchum, it certainly is a fascinating read, and I want to thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Next, we're going to head to PAX East, one of the biggest gaming festivals in the country, where efforts are being made to diversify gaming culture. So we're going to find out what's inside its diversity lounge. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the appeal of gaming diversifies, game advocates and industry professionals have struggled to address a persistent streak of misogyny inside of game culture, especially in online multiplayer environments. Addressing that so-called toxic culture in gaming was a minor theme at one of the biggest gaming festivals in the country, PAX East, in Boston, earlier this month. Concord Monitor arts editor Clay Wirestone attended the festival and spoke with producer Taylor Quimby about the introduction of a safe space for underrepresented gamers, which they called the Diversity Lounge.
It was just a large room that was located towards the front of the building. This was held at the Boston Convention Center. You know, it was supposed to be kind of a mini display space. So there were beanbags for people to sit down. There were kind of a separate group of exhibitors in there, highlighting kind of sexual and gender kind of diversity issues. There were some gamers with disabilities who had a booth in there. I think from what I saw and what I heard, and then from what people were writing about afterwards, it was a qualified success. People who were, quote unquote, diverse liked it. They liked the notion of a safe space. You know, my husband and I and our 3-year-old son went, and if you have a 3-year-old, you always are looking for a place to crash or just take some quiet time. So it was great for us. We would just go in there and chill out. I think in terms of the actual programming there, it looked clearly like something that was thrown together at the last minute. And, you know, for example, the gamers with disabilities who were there, which was great, but they actually had a prominent spot at PAX in for at least the previous 2 years. So this was just like a second booth,
right,
for them.
And in some way, you know, the fear is if you have a specific area that celebrates quote-unquote diversity, then that diversity doesn't get integrated into the rest of the actual festival.
And I think that was one of the main concerns and criticisms that people had. I think it was kind of too early at this point to really say whether or not that would happen, but that was something certainly that people wondered about. I think there was also a concern on the part of, you know, straight white guys who were there feeling like, well, can I go in this room? And I think this is one of the real issues whenever you have a conversation about diversity, and, you know, not just in games, but really in the world, really. Wanting diversity is not just wanting all the quote-unquote diverse people to be by themselves. It's about an actual interchange between everybody.
Clay Wirestone there, arts editor for the Concord Monitor and a regular guest on this show. He was speaking with Taylor Quimby about the Diversity Lounge, which was introduced at the gaming festival PAX East earlier this month. Well, one person that the Diversity Lounge might have hoped to attract is the woman behind this. That's the main theme from Assassin's Creed 3, Liberation, composed by Winifred Phillips. Video game music does so much more than provide background noise for gameplay. It adds to, maybe even defines the experience for gamers, and stays with them long after the adventure through mazes and mysteries is over. Here with more on what goes into creating those lasting musical impressions is Winifred Phillips. She's a multiple award-winning composer who's created music for such games as The Da Vinci Code, God of War, and many, many more. Now, even if you're not a gamer, these compositions and game culture have become extremely influential, and we are so happy to speak with a star in the field. Winifred Phillips' book, A Composer's Guide to Game Music, was recently published by MIT Press. And Winifred, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
So that music we just heard, your composition from Assassin's Creed 3 Liberation, won a Global Music Award. It really does have a dramatic, goosebump-inducing effect. So what went into creating it?
Well, thank you very much. The game itself was so inspiring. Assassin's Creed Liberation is the first game of the Assassin's Creed series to feature a female protagonist. And she lives in 18th century Louisiana. She is fighting for the rights of her people. She's an African-American. And it's a wonderful setting and a wonderful story that she's telling with her adventure. So that the culture of New Orleans at that period was so inspiring for me.
You look at it all. You look at the game itself. You look at historical context. Yeah.
Oh, well, certainly, especially with a game like Assassin's Creed Liberation, which is so focused on exploring history through a combination of marvelous science fiction time travel elements and a true dedication to letting players experience an authentic historical retelling. So that really is very exciting as a composer because it allows me to both be experimental and work with the science fiction elements and at the same time to be reflective of the time period and the culture and the musical influences that would have been prevalent in 18th century New Orleans.
Mm. When you're composing, are you thinking about how it enhances a gamer's experience? Are you just working from the game itself? Tell us a little bit about that process for you.
Oh, you always are thinking of the gamer because the gamer really is the reason why we're all here. And my job as a game composer is to enhance the gamer's sense of immersion in the experience that the game development team is trying to create. In essence, a video game at its best is kind of like entering the Matrix or walking onto the holodeck. It's that complete surrounding and immersion in an entirely different world, very imaginative world created in the minds of the developers. As a composer, what I want to do is communicate to the gamer all sorts of clues and background and emotional subtext to make the experience more alive and more impactful.
Let's listen to another one of your compositions. This one is from the Victoria's Lab segment of Little Big Planet 2. Well, for people unfamiliar with the game, we hear that there's a great difference. You know, the audience, the tone, the gameplay for Little Big Planet 2 is much different from Assassin's Creed. Now, how do you parse that out in your mind? How do you address music genre versus game genre?
Well, music genre is a collaborative decision that's made between the composer and the development team. We have conversations about what the experience should feel like for the player. In the example of Little Big Planet, it's very much a playground for the imagination. It's also quite interactive. The music reacts to the state of the game at any given time. And the music is written in layers so that instruments can be added and then subtracted so that the music always feels like it's lively and engaging and reacting to all of the decisions that the player makes.
Right. It's not linear at all, is it? There are all sorts of different tracks and little branches that one can go off to. And you're creating music, different music for all of those branches.
Yes. It is really a very exciting and interesting process for any composer. When I was creating, for instance, that piece of music that you just played, Victoria's Lab, it is essentially six different pieces of music. There are six layers, and each layer has the ability to play by itself and be satisfying. And yet all of them can be combined in different combinations so that the music can continuously reinvent itself as it plays. That is very challenging as a composer because you have to think of yourself as creating simultaneous compositions that can coexist, but can also stand alone. But at the same time, it's very interesting. It's very, it's like a puzzle. And it engages creatively and in a problem-solving way. So it keeps the experience fresh as a composer. You can't get bored. You can't get jaded. It's always challenging.
We're speaking with Winifred Phillips. She's an award-winning composer who's created music for games from Assassin's Creed 3, Liberation, Shrek the Third, God of War, Spore, Hero, many, many other popular games. She's also the author of a new book. It's called A Composer's Guide to Game Music, recently published by MIT Press. I'm wondering if you had a goal with this book. Are you sort of giving a practical guide, evangelizing, trying to make it real for all of those hopeful composers?
That was a big part of it. When I first got into game music composition, it was such an arcane world. It's very difficult. The learning process is quite steep because it's both a highly creative field, but it's also a highly technological one. As I was previously describing for you, the interactive music components, that's just one facet of all of the different complex systems that we need to learn. But I just didn't want that to stand in composers' way. It really is, in my mind, the creative art of the future, video games. It is the way in which I think stories will be told in the future. And it's such an engaging way in which artists can connect with an audience. So I just felt that there didn't exist a book right now that would speak to the challenges that a composer faces in a way that's welcoming and that invites into this process the kind of creative minds that really can contribute such wonderful things to video games moving forward into the future. That's just something that I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to help other composers to enter this field.
Well, it's also a hugely lucrative field and a place where a lot of people who, you know, may have been floundering trying to find a market for their compositions are now finding a market. I'm wondering, it sounds to me as if you may have been a gamer first, composer second. How did that go for you?
Yes, it never really actually occurred to me at the beginning that I could create music for games, but I had been a gamer for a very long time. When the idea first occurred to me to that composing for games might be in my future, I was working in radio. I was composing music for a series for National Public Radio called Radio Tales. And it adapted classic stories like science fiction, fantasy, and horror stories for the radio, like Dracula and Beowulf and things like that. So in a way, it was very good preparation for the work that I would do when I moved into video games.
And I admit, I smiled at your second most important asset for video game composers, other than a love of video games, an enjoyment of the quirkiness that defines the video game community. What do you think it is, Winifred, that sets gamers apart from non-gaming folk?
I just think that gamers and the game development community in general are so wholehearted in their love of what they do and the love of the video game field in general, games themselves. We throw ourselves into these worlds and we talk about them as if they're real, which is fantastic. The game conventions are just circuses of color and sound and light. There are costumed warriors roaming about. There are people shooting t-shirts out of cannons like it's a rock concert. There are people jumping up and down on trampolines and all sorts of dancing people in one corner, and other people are fighting each other with plastic swords and just jumping into the fantasy of it with childlike abandon, really. There's a sense of community in our ability to set aside reality, but at the same time to integrate these fantasy worlds into our own and to be inspired by the mythology and by the artistry and by the creative endeavors that these development teams bring into light. It's just fantastic. It's one of the things that really propels me as a creator of music for games.
Wow, I think I'm converted. I'm wondering what you see in the future for you and for the video game music industry, obviously a very quickly growing field.
Wow. Trying to predict what's going to happen in game development is sort of like trying to predict what's going to happen in history. It just tends to resist that effort. But especially because technology is moving at such a fast rate. The new consoles just came out, the Xbox One, the PlayStation 4. And we're only beginning to scratch the surface of what these technological advances are going to mean to the audio side of game development and particularly to music. I'm really looking forward to what that's going to mean for me as a composer, the kind of possibilities that will open up for me, the ability to think about music in different ways because of those new avenues that will be opened up by the advances in technology.
Well, Winifred, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. This was great.
Winifred Phillips, an award-winning composer. She's created music for such games as Assassin's Creed 3 Liberation, Shrek the Third, God of War, Spore, Hero, and many, many more. Her book, A Composer's Guide to Game Music, was recently published by MIT Press. If you'd like to hear more of Winifred Phillips' award-winning compositions, you can head on over to wordofmouthradio.org. Well, it's game over for now, but there is still plenty that you can play with over at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find a list of video game-inspired tunes, including some Nintendo Core ditties. And hip-hop tracks with video game samples. Now it's time that you make your way to the floor. Thank you so much for spending some time playing around with us today. We will be back with more Word of Mouth on Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. That game over.